Hello and welcome to Upfront, the podcast. I'm Katie Hannan. Opus Dei is a term many of us will have heard growing up in Ireland. A highly conservative global organisation of laypeople and clerics within the Catholic Church, it was always seen as secretive and powerful, especially during the 60s, 70s, 80s and into the 90s, and it is still around and active to this day. While it's often seen as an organisation for elites, for senior figures in business and politics, we are now getting an insight into what life was like inside Opus Dei for the members who serve them. Former members are speaking out. You may have heard them on Liveline this week. This followed a major investigation into Opus Dei published in the Financial Times 2 weeks ago. The person behind this recent campaign for justice for Opus Dei members is Anne-Marie Allen. Opus Dei have provided Upfront with a statement in which they say that they deeply regret that Anne-Marie was hurt by her time in Opus Dei, but they reject her allegations of exploitation. Take me back, Anne-Marie, right to the beginning. Ireland in the 1970s. You're a teenager growing up in a small village in County Cork. What were you like back then?
What was I like back then? I was young. I was 15 years of age, first of all. I was one of three. Sport was a huge interest in our family. So, yeah, I was going to school. I had lots of friends. You know, I was very interested in cooking. A fairly normal teenager, I think.
Okay, so then how did you get, do you end up coming into contact with Opus Dei at all then?
A friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, her mother saw an ad in the paper and answered it, and these two ladies came to visit her one Sunday afternoon, and my friend said, there's a girl back the road that would be interested in catering, and I wanted to be a chef at that point. So these two ladies came back and interviewed me in the house with my family, yeah.
And were they kind of travelling the country recruiting people for these colleges?
It seems, yeah, they were. They had ads in the paper and they used to go and visit people in their homes first, but what they used to do as well was maybe go to the local secondary schools, girls' secondary schools, and promote their courses in the secondary schools. But in my instance, it was they came to the family home.
Was it framed as an Opus Dei operation at that stage?
No, it was mentioned briefly during the conversation. My father had heard about it, but, you know, minimally. And then it was all about the course and how good the course was, and it was good for girls to go there. It was a safe place for, you know, there was a religious element to it and so on. And then we were invited, the family was invited for an interview to the school, which was in Ballyglunin in Tuam, County Galway.
So you were leaving school early then to do this catering course?
Yeah, I was leaving school early, yeah.
When did you realise that it wasn't like a normal, regular catering college?
First of all, we went for the interview, and I remember both of my parents were taken away separately and I was taken away separately to be interviewed. And we got the royal treatment, you know, these new worries, that's what they're called. They took us away. They were beautifully dressed. There was a tea and coffee and beautiful surroundings. And, you know, my father would say afterwards that the love bombing started then, the recruitment started then. So then my parents decided to send me there. It seemed quite wholesome. They sent me there in good faith that I would be safe. I was going with another couple of girls from my locality. We went there, we started then in October 1979, just the day after Pope John Paul II was elected. I remember it really well.
Okay, so you're in this college, but there was no curriculum. Am I right in saying that? There weren't qualified teachers there.
Correct. There was four of them there at that point, four numeraries. They weren't teachers, nor were they in any way trained in hospitality. There was no curriculum. It was on-the-job training, as it were. We basically started running a conference, working in a conference centre, and then working in a male student residence in Salt Hill in County Galway called Gurthard. And I was sent there maybe a week after that I started in the college. But there was no textbooks. There was no timetable. The classes were ad hoc. You know, there were some outside teachers came in and did some classes with us. But I now realise that they were trying to recruit them as well.
So, yeah. So describe to me then what you did all day.
I think a week in, I was sent in with three others into Gurthard University residence. And we basically worked there. We cooked all of the meals. We did, you know, housekeeping, and we waitressed, and we did the laundry. And we basically, we left, we got up every morning. We had to go to mass, even though they'd say that we had a choice, but, you know, there was pressure put on us if we didn't go to mass. And then we had our breakfast very quickly, and we got into a green bus, I remember, and we drove into Salt Hill in Galway, and we arrived there about maybe 8:30, 8:45, and we worked until 8 o'clock, 7 days a week. I was 15 years of age, yeah.
Yeah, tell me about these tutors.
They were, you know, the people that were in Ballyglunin. She was actually called Ballabert Catering Centre, and we were all appointed a tutor. And that was, that tutor was there to help us with our studies. But in fact, what it was the starting of the love bombing.
And love bombing, like that's a term I suppose you were used to using around cults and getting people into cults. But you're saying that you were sort of made feel special.
Yeah, this tutoring was supposed to help us with our studies, but was actually, what it was with that, they might talk to you about personal stuff, and you tell them personal stuff, and then they'd bring in the Opus way of dealing with it. You know, and next thing you were into that cycle. You know, if you pray for this, this will change. If you do this, this will change. And they're keeping on bringing in a scriva. And if you pray to the founder of Opus Dei, he was only dead about maybe 2.5 years at that point. You know, he'll help you. And next thing you're into the whole cycle. And, you know, they take you away on little walks and little chats and private little jokes. And you'd be made feel special. But certainly didn't help us with our studies. I can tell you that. I don't think my studies were ever discussed, you know.
You were brought to Rome just 6 months into your time there, weren't you?
Yes, we were brought to Rome in April of 1979, yeah. And there's a conference at Opus Dei. It's a youth conference that Opus Dei holds in Rome every year. And we were brought there under the guise that we were to see, visit one of their most prestigious catering colleges in Tiburtino in Rome. And I can tell you, we were there 30 minutes. We went in the front door, we turned around, walked into the kitchen, and we went back out again. But it was, again, it was a way of recruiting us. And, you know, we went to see he was the prelate at the time, Don Alvaro de Portillo. He gave talks. You know, we met, we went to a few sites, you know, like the Rowan Forum and a few different things like that. But it was, you know, an intense recruitment campaign to get you to join.
When did you first begin to believe that you had a vocation?
It was maybe about 6 weeks before that. The recruitment process was very quick. You know, I remember kind of looking at these ladies. They were beautifully dressed. They were so well spoken, you know. And I remember asking questions about Opus Dei. And then, of course, they really latched on to me then. And then, you know, they started telling me a lot more and really singling me out from the rest of them. From the rest of the students, and then one day I was called in, and I was told that the priest was in the confessional. And I think this is an important part about the recruitment process in Opus Dei, that the ordained priests of Opus Dei are heavily involved in the whole strategy to recruit you. And I find that quite shocking now looking back. So I was called in just to have a chat with the school's chaplain. And I remember I went in and I was quite surprised in the confessional. He said to me, I believe that, you know, you're interested in joining Opus Dei, and do you think you might have a vocation as an assistant numerary? And, you know, I was at that point, I was 16, a bit taken aback, and I didn't have the strength to challenge that, you know. And then next thing, the word vocation kept being mentioned.
But I suppose we should explain to people that there are various levels you can be at within Opus Dei. And when we talk about Opus Dei as an elite organisation, these are the numeraries and the supernumeraries we're talking about. These are members who devote themselves to Opus Dei, but they have a certain status within the organisation.
Yeah, there's different levels within the organisation. So the numeraries are the elite of Opus Dei. They are recruited from urban, well-educated, wealthy backgrounds. Then there's the assistant numeraries. We were recruited from poor, uneducated backgrounds. And this came from the founder of Opus Dei. These guidelines are all written down. And then there's the associates. They're another grade. They are full-time celibate members that don't live in centres of Opus Dei. They live outside. They live outside, but dedicate, they're members of Opus Dei. And then the supernumeraries then are the married members. And then there's two sections. There's the male and the female section. The assistant numeraries were the only ones that are allowed across the line. And then within the men's section, there was the priest section.
Okay, go back to assistant numeraries then. These are only women. And their role is very defined.
It's very defined, yes. The assistant numerary is there to provide the domestic service to the elite of Opus Dei in all of the centres of Opus Dei. So basically, the assistant numeraries do the cooking, the cleaning, the laundry service, and the waitressing of all of the centres of Opus Dei. And that's their only role. There's no upward mobility. You can't get promoted. That is your job for life. You're a celibate member.
So when you were thinking, you know, you were seeing the numeraries, the people who were very well dressed and coming from nice backgrounds, and you thought maybe that mightn't be a bad life, but you were kind of put in your place, weren't you?
I was put in my place. I wasn't attracted to the numerary role, really. I was attracted to the supernumerary role because I wanted to get married and have a family, that was. But I was quickly shut down and I was told, no, you have a vocation as big as a house as an assistant numerary. And this is a common line that would be used. You know, whenever you had a doubt, they'd come back to you and say, you have a vocation as big as a house.
You were told not to share this, though, with your family, weren't you?
Yeah. It was brought up that I didn't want to be an assistant numerary. I might want to be in a supernumerary. They said, and I said, I'll talk to my family about it. And they said, no, you're not to talk to your family about it, that they don't understand our ways and they don't understand your vocation. So at that point, I was 16 and I'm, the thought control was starting big time, you know.
So you did believe you had a vocation. You did basically sign up to be an assistant numerary.
I did. This is where the manipulation comes in. I was basically, you know, at the closer I got to it, you know, you're told if you don't follow your vocation in life, you'll be unhappy. It starts like that. If you don't follow your vocation, you know, you won't have happy relationships. If you don't follow your vocation, you'll go to hell. So it was very gradual. The manipulation. So by the time you get to join Opus Dei, you're frightened. You're completely isolated. You've no one to talk to. I've been separated from my fellow students. I've been separated from my family, and I had no one to discuss this decision with. And I still wanted to be a supernumerary, which was, you know.
But what you became was an assistant numerary, and again, your role then was basically serving everyone, but the men in particular, yeah.
But I served. I looked after the. I was in Garthard for a long, long time. But when I came back from Rome, I joined in Opus Dei in Rome. And when I came back from Rome, the love bombing stopped. I was dropped like a hot snot. I was then a full time. I basically had to take up all of the things that a full member of Opus Dei does. And I could see the attention being moved to another student. And that process started, and she was isolated and all that. But then I was a member of Opus Dei at that point. And, you know, I was told that I couldn't talk about, I was actually told not even to tell my fellow students that I was a member of Opus Dei. That's how isolated I was.
And when you were going about your business, cooking, cleaning, serving, you weren't allowed to even catch the eye of the people you were serving. Is that the way?
Oh, yes. When you're working in a male residence, yeah, there are two separate sections, and the assistant numerary was the only one allowed across the line. And that was when they were served their meals. So, yeah, it was an unusual way of serving people. It was kind of silver service and so on. But, yeah, you couldn't even look at them or catch their eye or anything like that. No, you couldn't speak to them at all. Are they you?
And all assistant numeraries were celibate?
All assistant numeraries were celibate for life, yes.
Tell me about the mortification of the flesh.
Mortification of the flesh, that was a big part of the Opus Dei practice. So, you know, we were told to be at the end of a shower, take a cold water blast. You know, you had to deprive yourself of something of every meal. You had to sleep on the floor one night a week without a mattress. You had to maybe sleep one night in the bed without a pillow. Then there was the thing that gets the most attention, really, is the use of the psyllus and the discipline. Now, I was 16 years of age. I was a child when that was given to me by an adult.
Okay, so just in case people didn't read Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, 20 years ago now since we were reading that book, but that really blew that whole idea up, didn't it? Because one of the characters in that book wore a metal psyllus. Is that, am I pronouncing that right? Could you explain for people who have never heard it what that involves?
Okay, it's a chain that's kind of, and there's kind of a, it's kind of like barbed wire with the sharp bits on the inside, and you tie that on your leg. We used to have to do it for 2 hours a day, and then the discipline then was a kind of a small whip that you had to whip yourself on Saturday, yeah, as a mortification, yeah.
On a Saturday,
yeah, to the Hail Holy Queen.
To the Hail Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy. What did you think when you were told to do this?
I was always extremely uncomfortable about it. I was a minor, Katie. I was 16 years of age, and it was just given to me, handed to me, and said, this is what you do. And I had never heard, I'd never seen anything like this. And you did it. You just did it. You know, I'm speaking with some of former members of Opus Dei, you know, we speak about it at length, and we would say, okay, this is the part of the mortification that gets a lot of press, gets a lot of coverage, especially from Dan Brown. But it wasn't the worst part, believe it or not. There was a thing called fraternal correction, which was a behavior control. Your behavior was completely controlled all the time, and you get these fraternal corrections for doing something wrong, and you had to take it. At the end of it, you'd have to say, oh, thank you very much for saying that to me. So you couldn't challenge anyone. And that was constant. That was every day. You could be pulled for instance, not passing the butter at the table. You know, maybe I got a fraternal correction one day because I was shouting at a Cork were playing in the All-Ireland, and I was shouting at the television, and I was using some unparliamentary language, and I got a very strong fraternal correction because I hadn't behaved like a saint. And I had to say at the end of it, oh, thank you very much, because you couldn't say, go away, would you? You know.
So put what that strike, then this is all about suppressing personality, suppressing the person.
Sexuality, suppressing your own values, your own opinions. You know, it was constant. You know, it was like, I would say, somebody did say, what was it? It was like Catholicism on cocaine. You know, you got up, you had to go to mass, you had to do 2 half-hour prayer a day, you had to do 15-minute spiritual reading, you had to do how many decades in the rosary, the whole thing. You had to do examination of conscience at nighttime. That was just on a daily basis. You had silence from 2 o'clock in the day until 6 o'clock in the evening, and the same from 9 o'clock at night until 6 o'clock the next morning. And then there was this fraternal correction. You had to do retreats. You had to do monthly recollections. You had to do a benediction on a Saturday. You had to do confession. You had to have this one-to-one personal chat with a member of Opus Dei where you revealed all of your inner feelings. And I mean, that was before we even got to the work. The hours and hours of work. I mean, it was so intense, you know.
And were you in contact with people from your old life while all of this was happening?
My contact with my family and with any friends I had was absolutely monitored, closely monitored. All of my letters that I wrote out were read. You left the envelope open, and you handed it in, and then anything they got back or that you got back was opened, and you may or you may not get those letters, depending on the directors that read them, if they felt they weren't suitable, you know.
And again, remind people, what year are we talking about now?
I was in Opus Dei from I was first in contact with Opus Dei in 1978 until about 1985.
So we're talking about the 1980s this was happening.
Yeah.
I know you said as well, you didn't have a purse. You had no access to money or to a front door key.
No purse, no front door key, no bank account. I never received any wages. I never held money. If I needed to make a phone call, I had to get permission and approval. Our movements were heavily monitored. A numeri always escorted us because that's what the director, that's what the founder of Opus Dei said. He said, never leave them on their own. So numeri was with us at meal times. If we had visitors, if people came to see us, there was always a numeri in the vicinity. And if we left the centre, there was somebody with us.
Did you get to go home to visit your family?
I did go home on occasions. Yeah, I did go home and I was brought down and somebody stayed nearby in the bed and breakfast usual.
I know then, of course, we're talking about the early 80s, and there was controversy in the international media about Opus Dei at that time and some bad publicity about Opus Dei. And this spurred your father into action, didn't it?
Yeah. He had got the information from a relative in the UK, and I think my dad then began to realise that things weren't as they were portrayed, and he started asking me to come home, and so that was a long, difficult period, to be honest. Yeah,
because you resisted that, didn't you?
I did resist it. Well, I was being told what to do from Opus Dei side. Everything was being monitored. Every phone call was being listened to, and I was being tutored beyond an inch of my life what to say. And then whenever my father was on the phone, they would sometimes be standing around me praying. If somebody came to see me, they'd be in the oratory praying, and I did, because I genuinely thought at that stage I had lost all power. I was completely manipulated by them, and I had no opinions, and I can tell you I was frightened out of my life. I think from the moment I joined Opus Dei until the day I left, I was absolutely devastated that this had happened to me.
And how did you see it as something that happened to you rather than something that you had, willingly run towards?
Because I was told this, you have a vocation as big as a house, and if you don't follow it, you're going to go to hell. You and your family will go to hell, and bad things will happen to you if you leave Opus Dei. Bad things will happen to you if you leave Opus Dei and talk about us. Your reputation will be destroyed. And
so eventually your father got you home and told them you weren't leaving, you weren't going back in.
Yeah, Opus Dei insisted that he write a letter saying that he wouldn't try, that he wouldn't keep me. And Dad wrote the letter and he said, I won't try to keep her. And then the day I did go home, which was the 22nd of November, 1983. They said we're two members came down with me and they said, we'll go, we'll call for you in the morning. And Dad said, she's staying, she's going nowhere. And they said, but you wrote a letter to say you wouldn't keep her. And he said, what I wrote was, I won't try to keep her, but I am keeping her. So it was a play on words, a very clever move on my dad's part, yeah.
I know you, even just saying the date there, it brought something back for you.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So we're exactly what, 40 years on now from that date?
Yeah, it was devastating, but I can absolutely pinpoint that day that happened, deep, deep down inside me, there was relief. That somebody had come to save me and it was my dad, But there was a long road ahead. There was a long road ahead.
A long road ahead, because you came out that time and you had to kind of put yourself back together again.
I did know, it has to be said that I was still a member of Opus Dei until the 19th of March, 1985, because it took me so long to kind of find my own opinions and find my own values and discover myself again. it took it so and until I was brave enough to say, I don't want to go back. I can't do this anymore. This is not me. So it took all of that length of time, and it was quite difficult because Opus Dei pursued me long and hard during that time, you know.
Yeah, they did. They actually approached you at a hospital appointment, am I right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, no, there was a lot of comings and goings, interactions before that. And you know, I have to say, for that first while, I did want to go back. But then, you know, I began to come around. You know, that life outside was actually quite good, and that the world was a kind place, and that people were very, very kind. And you know, the village I came from, some of the people there were just so good to me. During that time, you know, that I can forever be thankful for, really, you know. But it took me that long to kind of say, I don't want this anymore. This isn't for me, and it's wrong, and that. But at that point, I believed I was abandoning my vocation to Opus Dei at the same time, but I chose to do that.
You had very few life skills then.
I had nothing. I had there was a basic cookery course, which really wasn't worth the paper it was written on. I had no social skills. I had no qualifications. I didn't have a GEU, an enter cert. I didn't have a legal cert. I had absolutely nothing. So I had to start. I had no money. I knew I was different from everyone else. So I had to start from scratch at 22 years of age.
And you did. You went back and you did your leaving cert on your own.
I did, yeah. I went back to school at night time in the School of Commerce in Cork. And I did my leaving cert over 2 years. I did every little course I could find, receptionist courses, typing courses.
And you ended up in the prison service, working in the prison, not in the right side of the prison service, I should say, Anne-Marie. Important to point out, important to clarify. I wondered whether that experience you had of being so institutionalised so young for that period of time, was that a help or a hindrance when it came to working in the prison service?
That's a question I've been asked. I've been asked quite often. And I think actually it was a real help, because I went from one institution to another. You know, I was working as part of a hierarchical organisation. I was wearing uniform. I was working long hours. But there was a stark difference, because I was treated very well. I was paid very well. I had days off. I could, if when I was sick, I could go sick, and the management were very nice people.
And you did very well in there, didn't you? You rose through the ranks. You were very senior before you left.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was part of the governor's team. Yeah, for ten years. I ended up in Portlaoise. It was Portlaoise campus at the time. It's now they're both separate institutions. But I was part of the management team on Portlaoise campus, which was the Midlands prison and Portlaoise prison, and I worked in both.
Now you have your own business as a life coach, executive coach, and again, all your life experiences must be hugely beneficial in what you're doing now.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, it's a pleasure to have people come to me for help, you know, and, you know, I think I'm able to help them, you know, to get through difficult times and, you know, to look at the strength that they have within themselves.
How are you now, Henry?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm in a good place. You know, I did go through a few difficult, chaotic years after I came out. But education, I think, was the thing that saved me. I did my degree, I did my master's and so on. And I think one of the pivotal points in realising that I was wronged, that there had been a complete disregard and contempt for my own human rights, was when I was in UCC. I was doing an assignment and I came across the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I remember reading it and you know, really realizing that my human rights had been completely violated. I think that was a huge wake-up call.
And then tell me then, because you did keep your counsel for a long time about your past in Opus Dei and what had happened in there. So what then prompted you to decide, okay, I'm going to speak out, somebody has to do it, and I'm going to try and connect with other people who have been where
okay.
I was.
When I was in the Midlands prison, I met a chaplain, a very, very nice lady, who sadly passed away last year, and she asked me about my past, and I told her, Sister Breatha, and she just said to me one day, would you think it might help to speak to former members? And I had never met another member. I'd met the odd person, but you must realise that when you leave Opus Dei, you're not allowed to get in contact with people. You're also told you not to talk to any other members about us. So for 35, 36 years, I hadn't spoken to anyone. So she put me in contact with an ex-New Worry. We met for lunch and I was flabbergasted at the amount of people that had left. And I found speaking to her was hugely therapeutic. I found it very, very healing. So then I went on my own journey of trying to find former members. Then through business, I came across a person whose sister had been in Opus Dei, and I had heard that she had left. So I reached out, and that was maybe 6-7 years ago. She said, I'm not ready to talk. And then last year, she said, I'm ready to talk. And that's Tina Fogarty.
Who, of course, also featured in that Financial Times article as well.
So we the two of us then decided, you know, that there's so many ex-members. There was a huge amount of shame and guilt for having left Opus Dei, shame and guilt for having done this to our families, shame and guilt. We then discovered that there's 43 assistant New Worries taking a class action against Opus Dei in Argentina. The same story as ourselves. And there's criminal charges pending there in Argentina. So we joined them in a complaint to the Vatican about our treatment at the hands of Opus Dei. So then we realised that, you know, many people don't have pensions. Many people didn't have money, savings, careers when they left Opus Dei. And there needs to be, you know, they need to get paid.
There needs to be a redress, basically. You're saying there needs to be a reckoning for what happened. And that is an important point, that for many people in your situation, their social security payments were not made. So people now find themselves in their later years not able to access pension entitlements.
Yeah, 100%. And many of them have got health issues due to the long work hours. And their families are maybe passed away, or they're removed from one country to another, and they've lost contact with their families and so on. We just feel that that our human rights were breached. We feel that we were coerced, and we think that needs to be addressed by Opus Dei and by maybe authorities. And I suppose that's one of the reasons we're speaking out.
I know Opus Dei told Liveline that they had been in contact with you and with Tina Fogarty for a number of months.
Well, what happened in my case was that there was a contact was made through a third party asking to meet me to help me heal.
If people are listening to this and not looking at you, you are pulling a face at this moment.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is because I have the much longer response here in front of me that the Opus Dei gave. They say the vocation of assistant numeries being followed by thousands of women around the world with freedom, love and commitment, and has the same dignity as any other life choice. They do say now that assistant numeries are paid now around the world.
There's a website called opuslibros.org, and there's 15,000 testimonies on that. And in there, you will find that in some parts of the world, the status of and the treatment of assistant numeries is still the same.
Again, I have to say, I suppose Opus Dei deny this, of course. What would you like to see happen now that you have spoken out and others are finding the courage to speak out as well?
All of the people that worked that were unpaid, that they need to be paid their wages. They need to get compensation. They need to have their pension entitlements restored, and they need to be reimbursed for all of the counselling from their treatment. Hopefully that, the assistant numeracy grade, is it fit for purpose? Does it need to be there? I think that it is hugely discriminatory. I think it's wrong on every level. And keep in mind that these assisted movements were recruited as children.
And that was your childhood?
That was my childhood. And many, many childhoods. And it's women. It's women again. If English speaking people want to, because what we found is that there is there are many English speaking ex-members coming forward. It's widely spoken about in the Spanish speaking world. But for if English speaking ex-members want to get resources to help, there's www.opuslibros.org. There's also a Reddit page set up by a journalist, and that's called Opus Dei Exposed. There's also the ODAN website, Opus Dei Awareness Network in America. And of course, Katie, please, my number and my email address can be made available to anyone that wishes to contact me.
If anybody wants to get in touch with us, we will, of course, pass on those details. And that was Anne-Marie Allen. In response to the allegations raised in this podcast, Opus Dei said they are very sorry and deeply regret that Anne-Marie was hurt by her time in Opus Dei, but they reject the accusation of exploitation. They said assistant numeraries are women and their chosen work is caring for the people and centres in the family setting of Opus Dei. This work is paid in accordance with the employment legislation of the countries in which they live. They said in cases in the past where there may have been irregularities in social security contributions or bad experiences within the organisation, Opus Dei recognises that these things can have happened, but says it needs the people concerned to make a formal complaint. You can read the full statement on the Upfront website. So that's it. Thanks for listening to Upfront, the podcast. If you want to get in touch with us, you can message us on social media at RTE Upfront or via WhatsApp. Our WhatsApp number is 087-677-1000. And don't forget to tune into Upfront every Monday evening at 10:35 on RTE One and on the RTE Player. And I'll see you then.